Hello and welcome to Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis, and we're pleased to be able to share this free webinar with participants from all around the world. You are a big part of this event, so I want to be sure you know how to participate. If you're on the MomsFightingAutism.com website, you'll see a gray box on your screen, and you can click Ask a Question to send questions for our presenter. The more questions we get, the better the presentation is for everyone. You'll also see slides on the gray box. Click that button when the presentation begins to view the slides. You can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. And be sure to mute your computer if you're using your phone so you don't get an echo. When we get to Q&A, those participating with their telephone can ask a question by pressing star 2 to alert me that you have a question. And don't be shy, because the questions you ask are probably the same ones somebody else is afraid to ask. We are joined tonight by Valerie Herskowitz. Did I say your last name right, Valerie?
Perfectly.
Herskowitz. we're going to be discussing improving speech and language skills for individuals with autism. Valerie has been a speech and language pathologist since 1978. She has spent many of those years working with individuals who have autism and other developmental disabilities. She was the founder of Dimensions Therapy Center, a facility that offered therapy services to children with special needs. She was the recipient of the Stevie Lifetime Achievement Award for her work with autistic and special needs children, and has also been honored for starting two innovative community programs, Mothers of Special Needs Individuals and the National Autism Registry Family Club. Her youngest son, Blake, was diagnosed in 1993 with autism. Her professional journey as a therapist and as a parent of an autistic child have combined to give Ms. Herskowitz the unique insights to help families cope with problems they face in parenting a child with autism. She is a contributing writer for a number of national publications on the subject of autism and is the author of the book, Autism and Computers, Maximizing Independence Through Technology, and Always Leave Them Laughing. She writes a blog that focuses on issues of parenting an older or an adult child on the spectrum. Welcome, Valerie.
Thank you, Nancy. This is really fun. I'm really happy to be here. And as Nancy mentioned, I'm both a professional and a mom. So when we talk tonight about things, I'm going to be referring a little bit to my own experiences with my son, Blake, because, as I like to say, I don't only talk the talk, I walk the walk. And I think that really does give me some insight into being a speech pathologist. Just to give you a little bit of background about me, other than what Nancy already told you, interestingly, my life has always been about developmental disabilities. As a speech pathologist for 35 years, I was trained in Miami at the University of Miami Medical School in working with special needs and developmental disabilities. Children back then were not necessarily classified as having autism. As you know, through the years, the way that we classify autism has changed. But the population of children there has always been quite a few children, in my caseload, even in the earlier years, that had autism. And as the incidence of autism increased, so did my work in the autism community. So you can imagine what kind of crazy irony it was for me to have a child in the summer of 1993 to be diagnosed with autism. But that is what happened. Previous to that, my older son, Hunter, had a speech and language delay, so I worked with him too, but he didn't have autism, thank goodness. Right now he's a happily married 23-year-old man who is becoming a behaviorist. But unfortunately, his younger brother, even though he had speech and language delays, did have autism. And so my life has really been about combining my professional and my personal experiences, and Blake really is the light that illuminates my path. So a lot of the things we're going to be talking about tonight really are things that I myself have gone through with my son. Here's a picture.
I'm sorry, Valerie. I'm having trouble viewing the slides as a participant.
Okay.
Can you, first of all, can you be sure that you're logged in to the slides? And I'm sure you are because you're talking about them. Second, can you make sure that you're pressing the triangle at the bottom to advance the slides?
Right. Would you, I just went to the first slide.
Okay.
The first advance of the slide to where it has a picture of my son. Do you see that?
No, I do not.
Okay.
You used the link I sent you?
Mm-hmm.
To log in. Okay. There's always a snafu, so we're just going to work through this here. I'm going to resend you the link just to make sure that you have the right one.
All right.
Via email. Okay?
Okay. And while I'm waiting for that, I'll tell you a little bit about what we're going to be talking about tonight. We're going to talk about speech and language, and when we talk about speech and language and dealing with individuals with autism, obviously there's a wide variety of different kinds of children and different types of issues. It ranges anywhere from children who are unable to use verbal communication as their method of communication, as well as children who do have some speech and language skills. And the first area that we're going to talk about is going to be children who have issues in dealing with using speech as a means for communication. I know you don't have the slide, and we can go back to it when we do have it. But basically, when you have a child, and I really want, this is something that I feel very, very strongly about. A lot of times I will ask a parent, does your child speak? Is your child a verbal communicator? And sometimes parents are a little unsure of that. They're not really sure. They may say, well, my child talks, but I have to get a little bit more in depth into what that means. What does it actually mean to be a verbal communicator? A verbal communicator, if you think about it, has to be somebody that uses speech as a means to communicate, and actual verbal speech. And the actual word that we really need to focus on is communication. Because what I find oftentimes with parents is that they confuse a child that they might have who maybe is able to imitate a few words, or you can get a child to say what you want them to say, but that's not really, really communication. When I talk about communication, I'm really talking about somebody who is able to get a thought from their brain into a verbal word out of their mouth and be able to communicate it to that to another person. Nancy, I don't see another email from you. You send it to info at... let's see. Okay, here we go. Let's try this one. Okay, but there's no link there.
Hmm.
Oh, that's the same email that you sent me from before?
Yes, I just resent it because that link is good. Just to make sure we're on the same page.
Okay, do you see it now?
Let me see. Go ahead and advance the slide and let me see if it changes for me because I do have the starter slide, the original.
Okay, I'm advancing them. Do you see them?
Hold on, I had to reboot. still on the home page here. Let's see what's going on. Did it tell you that you were going to take control of the slides when you clicked on it? Okay.
Let me see if I put, you know what, let me try and put the link into a different web browser, because sometimes that's the problem. Do you have a particular web browser that you think works better than others? Or
I use Firefox, but that's just me.
All right, let me try and use that one and see if it's better. Because sometimes that might be what the problem is.
Let's Thanks, folks, for hanging in there with us. We're going to get these slides up so we can talk intelligently and show you pictures at the same time.
Okay, how's that? Now, let's see. Does that work better?
Let me see.
It doesn't ask me to take control or anything, but...
Can you try advancing?
Mm-hmm, I am.
Wow, why is it just stuck on that first page? It's so strange. I mean, never, like, once we fiddle with it.
I'll tell you what. Let's go ahead and...
I can advance them for you.
Oh, okay. That would be fine.
Okay. You just tell me when to go.
Okay. Let's go to slide 4.
What is augmentative?
No, slide 4 is non or low verbal.
Low verbal. We're
okay.
Up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Got it.
So what I was saying is that we really have to differentiate from, if you're talking about your own child, we really have to figure out for, if you're going to be working on their speech and language, whether you have a child who has the ability to communicate verbally. And it's very, very important to make that distinction. And I want to just say that if you have a child who does say some words that they're able to imitate you or attempt or have words that are similar to words that you're saying, let's for this situation not say that they are verbal communicators, because I don't want you to think that at this point for them, and that doesn't mean in the future it'll be different, that would be the avenue that you should be going on. Really, a child who does not have adequate verbal abilities should really be looking at something called AAC, or Alternative or Communication System. And you can see on that slide, first of all, a picture of my son when he was younger using a dedicated voice output system, which we'll talk about in a minute. But you can see the different types of alternative or augmentative communication systems. So if you have a child at this point, let's go on to slide 5. What is augmentative and alternative communication?
Okay.
We have that one out? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That is really a method that we use when a person is having difficulty communicating through verbal speech. It can be used as an alternative, which is the first A in augmentative, or it can be augmentative, which is the other A. So you may have a child that has some verbal speech, but they're going to also be using AAC as an assistive way of increasing their communication. So let's go on to the next slide.
Okay.
What is the purpose of communication? And really, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings by saying, if you have a child who is able to imitate many words, but they're just not using those words right now in a communicative way, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but I would not consider them to be verbal communicators at this point, and I would be looking at them to try and develop some nonverbal or augmentative means to communicate. And the reason is that what is the purpose of communication? Well, it's obviously to send and receive messages. So let's go to slide 7. And this is what I mean in an illustrative way. To be a good communicator, to be an effective communicator, you need to have a sender. And that little picture is my son many, many years ago. And the reason I use him as an example is because this is the journey that I went on with my own child. I realized when he was very young that though he did imitate quite a few words, actually 150, and the way he imitated them, I don't want to say was very precise, but he was able to imitate them, he was not able to communicate a word, a thought in his brain. So let's say he had the word, here's that little funny cartoon of a person with a little thought in their brain of a cookie. And when he was little, he would have to try and tell me, and there's a picture of me many, many, many years ago, that he wanted this cookie. So it would have to go from his brain into my brain, meaning that I didn't know he would want a cookie until he would be able to communicate it. And what I oftentimes see with parents is that they are trying to get their child to say a word, but they already know what that word is. It's very, very different when that person doesn't know what it is their child wants. And I remember distinctly the day and where we were when that came to my head. I was in a grocery store. My son was still very little. He was still little enough that he was sitting in the cart, so he had to have been maybe 3 or 4 years old. And he was literally screaming. And he was screaming because he could not communicate to me what it was in that grocery store that he wanted me to purchase. That was the light that went off in my head at that point, that I had a nonverbal child. Up until that point, I was telling myself I had a verbal child. He was able to repeat a lot of words. Maybe I was able to somehow give him enough prompting or cueing to say those words. But in reality, he was not a verbal communicator. And that's when the light went off to me. So if we go to slide 8, and we see effective communication means that we shared meaning. And that was not happening for him at that time in that grocery store. So if we go to slide 9, if no meaning has been shared, and that was exactly what happened in that grocery store, no communication has taken place. So what you need to ask yourself at this point is, if you have a child, doesn't matter what age they are, even if they have verbal communication, verbal abilities, verbal behavior, do they have verbal communication or not? And you have to really be honest with yourself, and this is a very hard thing for a lot of parents to do, and this happens where I have families in my office, and we have to really come up and sometimes realize that no shared communication, no shared meaning is taking place. So if you get to that point and you're okay, and again, slide 9, slide 10, I reiterate that imitation is not purposeful communication. Then what you need to do is you need to accept the fact that you're going to need to bring in the AAC, either alternative or augmentative communication. So let's talk about these different kinds of communication, these nonverbal types of communication. The first one we're going to talk about, many of you might have heard of, let's go to slide 11, is called PEC, or the Picture Exchange Communication System. And again, just to, and many of you have had an opportunity to use the PEC system. What I want to clarify again, which is oftentimes a misunderstanding, PECs are not pictures. PECs is a system. Pictures or items that are used can be used for many different purposes. But when you, so PECs, you don't say to someone, oh, I have PECs. My son has PECs. PECs is a system. My son uses PECs as a system for communication. That would be correct. It's a 6-step protocol for teaching a person how to exchange a visual picture that would be something that they would want or something that they see and want to describe. And it also teaches an ability to initiate. It's not just used for a person to say, okay, what is it you want? It's used to initiate. What we do with PECs is we teach children to go get a picture from whether it's a book or whether it's a board that has pictures Velcroed to them, and then pull that picture off the book or off the board. So look for an individual, whether it's a parent or a teacher or their brother and sister or any kind of a human being that's going to fulfill their wants and needs, and give them that picture, and and essentially in a nonverbal way communicate to that person that that is what they want or that is what they say. That is what PECS is. So if you have pictures that you're using with your child in a different way, and there are different ways of using visuals, then you're not using PECS, but you're just using visual systems. But PECS is one of the most common, one of the most important means of using visuals for communication. But there are other ways that are also good. One of the ways that we can use communication is through what we call choice boards. Choice boards are when you have not Velcro pictures, but just pictures that, let's say that you have printed out from your computer onto a piece of paper, and let's say you laminate that piece of paper, and you go up to a person and you say, what do you want? And they point to what they want. That's called a choice board. That's not called PECS. It's called a choice board. It is a visual means of using augmentative communication, and it's perfectly fine, and it has a wonderful usage. I personally, with my son, use choice boards all the time. I use it on his iPad. I use it with just plain pictures all the time because he responds very well to choice boards. When he was younger, he was unbelievable with PECS. I mean, he had probably 200 PECS on boards and books and things like that. Later on, we went to a few different more sophisticated means of communication, but when he was younger, we had pictures of, I was like constantly making texts for him, constantly. Here's, if we go to slide 12, you can see some different examples of text pictures. You can see how some of them are, if you look on the left, you can see that some of them are more symbol-oriented. You can see in the middle how they are usually on Velcro, and on the right, you can see pictures of how my preference, which is to use actual photographs, which I find, and with 90% of the kids that I work with, I use, that's what I use for PECS. So let's move on to slide 13, and let's talk about sign language, because sign language is another wonderful, nonverbal AAC communication system. And right now, that's my son's choice of what he will go to first, which will be sign language. And it wasn't always like that. Now, why even do signs? I mean, we have so many other wonderful ways of communicating. What's the benefit of signs? Well, the good thing about sign is that with two hands or one hand, a person can communicate what they want. They don't need to go get a picture. They don't need to go use a machine. They have their two hands readily available. It's a very quick way and a very practical way of communicating. It also, being what we call a motor planning type of system, in other words, the brain is actually telling the hands to motorically move in a certain way, it imitates the same type of motor planning that verbal communication does. So we often use, and you'll find in many behavioral programs, we use sign language as a means to accelerate the use of verbal behavior as well. And signs are able to be physically prompted. In other words, we can use our hands to shape a person's hands to start to teach them how to make signs. So it is a system that has its advantages. Let's go to slide 14. But sign language also has its disadvantages. Now, one of the things that I just mentioned to you before, something called motor planning, you may have heard the term before. For those of you who are not familiar with motor planning, motor planning is when the brain tells a certain part of our body how to sequence movements, whether it be the hands, whether it be the legs, whether it be our mouth and our tongue and part in, for speech or for walking or for using pencils or for whatever it is. That's called motor planning. And motor planning is a very important part of sign language. But unfortunately, people with autism usually have very poor motor planning. So the traditional methods of teaching sign language to children, when I say traditional methods, I'm talking about methods that have been traditionally used with non-autism, people that don't have autism, like people that are hard of hearing or deaf. Those are more traditional methods, and you might have heard of American Sign Language or signing exact English. And these methods are excellent when used with a non-autism population, but with an autism population, they're oftentimes not successful because they require a person to have very good motor planning, which, again, people with autism don't. And, again, one of the other reasons is that traditional signs, only 10 to 15% of them are iconic. In other words, look like the sign. So if you think about what that means, it means that you've probably seen people doing sign language before in one way or another. Sometimes the sign, you can know what the sign is even though you don't know sign language because you can tell what they're doing. For instance, the sign for baby is you take your hands and you look like, you know, you fold your hand one over the other and you rock, and it looks like you're rocking a baby. That would be called an iconic sign because pretty much anybody would be able to tell what that means. But the other 85 to 90% don't look anything like the sign. So sometimes that's very difficult for an individual with autism. Well, that was the problem I had with my son, who wanted to learn sign language, but he had very poor motor planning, as most individuals with autism do, and he was a concrete thinker. So we had to come up with a way to teach sign language to him, if that's what he was trying to do. And if you go to slide 15, I have a link up there. Don't worry about the links. I'll tell you about them later. Don't write anything down or be concerned with them. But what I did was I developed a program, this is probably going back about 10 years ago, for individuals specifically with autism. It's a sign language program that addresses motor planning specifically for individuals with autism. And if it's something that you're interested in doing, I'll be talking about a few of these webinars that I've put together over the years that you can get more information about some of the things we're talking about tonight. They're inexpensive. They're like $10. I don't promote them in any way. It's not how I make my living. But if you are interested later at the end, I'll show you how you can learn more about them. And sign language, my program that I call Sequence Sign, is actually available, and you can learn how to do that with your child. Let's go on to slide 16. And I'm sure that you all have heard about the iPad and its use with autism. I'm sure it's so big now that it's on major networks. They have programs on it. Every time I turn around, there's another article about apps for autism. And that's something that I'm very, very heavily involved in. My son uses an iPad. A lot of kids that I work with use iPads. I'm very involved in technology anyway. I've been involved in technology since the mid-90s in working with people with autism, because people with autism, they just take to computers and technology like fish to water. So there's so much that you can do using technology, using computer software, using programs for individuals, and iPads have been a very successful tool that we use for individuals with autism. Right now, there's close to 400 different apps available specifically for autism. And again, if you're interested, I have done some webinars on autism. You can learn more about those through those apps. And there's some wonderful websites, too, that deal with these apps. But when there's 400, it's hard to really narrow it down. A lot of my work as a consultant is that I work with families to help them develop programming in working with their own child with autism on the iPad, and I make recommendations of different apps that are appropriate. They're not just for communication. There's apps for developing social skills. There's apps for developing the ability to understand emotions. There's apps for organizational skills, language development, behavior. Pretty much any area that you would need reading, math, that you would work on with your child, there's an app for it. You know, that's an old cliche. I have an app for that. And literally, there is an app for almost everything that we do with children with autism. So if you want to learn more about, more globally about AAC, I do have a webinar on that. And again, we have the other webinars on iPad and also on sign language. So that's all I'm going to say right now about using AAC. Let's move on. If you have a child who is a speaker, some manner, shape, or form, and let's talk about children who maybe do speak and are verbal communicators, but that doesn't mean they have perfect language. They often, here's other types of problems or issues in dealing with children who have autism and with their language. Are we on the same slide, Nancy, where it says language delay at the top?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great. So you can see that children with autism, even those that are verbal, will have difficulty understanding spoken language. It's not just about what they say, but it's about what they understand. So those are areas that are very important to work with. Formulating sentences. I can't tell you how many parents I have who come to me because their child, they talk in one word, you know, they say one word at a time, and they don't know what to do to bridge that gap to get them to the point where they can start putting words together, or they might just have two words, or they might have just a phrase here and there. Grammar, conversational turn-taking, many children have difficulty. They can maybe formulate sentences, but they just don't know how to use it in a conversation. Even with our very high speakers or individuals that have pretty good language, we have difficulty with many of our children, many of our individuals, understanding what we call non-literal language, which is things like idioms, jokes, inferencing, all those kinds of things. And then, of course, body language and other nonverbal cues oftentimes stump even a very good verbal communicator. So let's go on to slide 19. These are some issues that speech pathologists deal with as well, and we consider this to be in the realm of communication, which is nonverbal characteristics dealing with, as I just mentioned to you before, body language, facial expression, eye contact, very often an issue. These are all social types of issues, lack of peer relationships, and the inability to share enjoyment with others or even to just share with others, something that you might have heard of called joint shared attention. So, we're going to talk now about, something called the seven stages of language acquisition. The seven stages of language acquisition were developed by a company called Laureate Learning Systems. And Laureate Learning Systems, just to tell you a little bit about them, is a software company that specifically sells software for language. They've been around now for about 20 years. You may want to check them out. And what they do is they look at where a child is functioning in terms of their language development through these stages. And when you can figure out what stage your child is at, then you can go onto their website and they'll tell you what software that would be appropriate for your child. So it's a really good hierarchy for them. However, the seven stages of language acquisition also serves another purpose, and not just to identify what kind of software you could be buying from Laureate Learning, but also to figure out what you should be working on, what goals and what training skills you should be working on with your child. So what I recommend right now is for you to get a pencil or a pen and a piece of paper if you have a verbal child. And as we start talking about these different stages of language acquisition, try and think about, I'm going to try and describe a lot of characteristics of these different seven stages. And your job tonight is to try and identify what stage you feel your child is in. Because the goal would be then to move your child to the next stage. So if your child is stage one, we want to move them to stage two. And if they're at stage two, our goal is to move them to stage three, and so on and so forth. And as we do that, I'll give you some ideas on how to do that. I might give you some resources, some things that I've created, or some other resources on how to do that, and some tips. So this is something you can do as an exercise, and I use this all the time. This is oftentimes when I'm doing a consultation with families, and I do consultations with families. I help them develop all kinds of programming, home programming for them, for their child, and I do it via Skype or on the phone, and I do it. I have children I deal with all around the world. I have them in Australia, in Belgium, in Canada, some in India, and then I have them here in the United States. And really, this is the very first thing I do. We try and identify what stage the child is in. It gives me a really good idea of some of the things that we're going to recommend. And you can do this yourself tonight. I'm sorry?
I said I'm so excited.
Oh, good. So now these seven stages are based on normal development of a normal non-disabled or non-developmentally delayed person, but they're very illustrative for being able to identify what stage a child or an individual with developmental disabilities is in. Now, we're going to go to the next slide, which is slide 21. And that's stage one. Now, stage one could literally refer to a nonverbal person as well. So if you do have a nonverbal child, or you have someone that you know that's nonverbal, they may be at this stage. They may not be. They may be more advanced in this stage. But in my very young children, oftentimes I have stage one children, and they may be 2 or 3 years old, even though a typical child would only be between 0 and 4 months. And the reason for that is that the characteristic of a stage one person is that they have no intention to communicate. If you think about a young baby, and you think about, and I teach at Nova University, and the class that I teach is speech and language development. I teach graduate students in speech and language who are budding speech pathologists. And what we talk about is normal development. And we talk about a baby who literally just acts from stimuli in the environment, and what it is the caregiver, whether it's mom or somebody taking care of the baby, they're responsible to interpret what that baby wants. That baby's going to cry, that baby's going to chew, that baby's going to make noises. And as the mom or as the dad or as the caregiver, we have to figure out what it is that they want. They are not trying to communicate to us. They are not doing this on purpose. They are not having a thought in their mind that says, I'm hungry, I'm going to cry now, and mommy will come and bring me food. Not a stage one person. And what happens sometimes is I actually have, you know, young children who have autism who come to me who really do not have any intention of communication yet. And if that's the case, if you do have a very young child and you don't feel that your child has any intention of communicating, in other words, they don't do anything to tell you what they want. They're not pointing to what they want. They're not making noises to tell you what they want. They're basically just waiting for you to interpret anything. They'll be at stage one. And my first goal, if you see in color there, my first goal is to teach them something called cause and effect. And if we go to slide 22, the next slide, you'll see that a child who is preverbal oftentimes, and preverbal is not the same as nonverbal, preverbal child is a child who may eventually become a verbal child, oftentimes does not have the concept of cause and effect. And cause and effect, again, is when, and another word for it could be intentional communication, is when somebody does something in order to create an effect. If you have a young child and you go to Toys R Us and you go to the Fisher Price aisle and they have toys there that are based on the developmental age of a child, oftentimes you see toys that, for instance, you push a button and something pops up, or you push a button and music comes on, or you do something and something happens. Those toys are called cause and effect toys in the developmental universe, because that is a very important skill. And it does happen that even with our 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds, that some of them have not developed that, and they cannot become communicators. Verbal or nonverbal communicators, they cannot become communicators until they learn how to control their environment. So it's not going to be unusual if you do have a very young child and you don't feel that they have any control over their environment, it's time for you to invest some energy into working on cause and effect. And you can do that in a variety of different ways. You can get the Fisher-Price toys. You can go onto the Laureate Learning website and put in stage one, and you'll come up with some cause and effect software. You can work with them to teach them different things about cause and effect that they can actually create something to happen. They can make something happen. And that should be your first goal if you have a child who is pre-verbal or you have a child that doesn't have cause and effect. And you can't put the cart before the horse. You can't teach a child communication if they don't have cause and effect. So if you do have a child and you're starting to maybe think about some of these things we're talking about tonight, and if you recognize the fact, you know, I've been trying, a light bulb might go off in your head, and you might say, well, that's why I can't teach my child communication. They don't understand basic cause and effect. And that should be your first goal. Start there. So let's go to slide 23. Slide 23 is intentional communication. Normally or typically it would be in a child who's what we call an infant, 4 to 9 months. And at this point, we have a baby or we have a child who is able to tell us what they want, not verbally, but through some sort of nonverbal means. Usually it's going to be crying. Or maybe they're going to give you eye contact, or maybe they're going to look at something. But if you have had typical developing children, you may remember that as they got a little older and they were sitting up, they might start to make noises, and then you start learning that when they make that noise, that means that they want something. They might want a kiss, or they might want a hug, or they might want something to eat, or they might want you to change their diaper. Well, if you have a child with autism, that might occur later on, but that's okay. And what you might see in a child with autism is you might see the beginning stages of pointing. You might see them starting to point to things. You might see them go take your hand and pull you. That's a very common situation with a child who has autism, and it's a huge flag to me that I need to start working on communication, a systematic communication with that child. When I have a child who takes a caregiver, mom, dad, or teacher, brother, sister, a babysitter, by the hand and pulls them to the refrigerator and then stands there, or pulls them to the closet where all the toys are and just stands there, or pulls them to the front door, they are trying to communicate to you. They are trying to tell you. And I bet there's a lot of you guys out there who can identify or think, that's my kid, because that's a very, very common characteristic of a child who does not have a communication. But that is telling me at that point that we want to start at that point. When you have a child who is starting to signal you that they are wanting things, that's the prime time that I jump in and start either working on verbal communication and or some of these other nonverbal systems that we talked about earlier. So tip two is, we talked about PECS earlier, dedicated voice output systems, which we call VOCAs, like an iPad app. We have to teach them initiation. We have to teach them initiation. Initiation is when we teach children to learn how to, on their own, communicate. We don't want to just teach them to respond to what do you want. And that's, again, a little bit of the problem in developing spontaneous communication. And again, something I see very frequently is a parent who comes to me and says, oh, yeah, my child tells me what they want, but I first have to say, what do you want? And so you got to be careful. That's called prompt dependency, and you don't want to do that. If you use PECS or you have been trained or the system, the school system or the speech pathologist that your child is working with is actually doing PECS the correct way, you will not develop a prompt-dependent child. Okay, let's go on to slide 25. And I don't want to sound like an infomercial, so I'm just going to throw this in. If you do want to work on increasing verbal productions in children at this stage of the game, I do have a webinar on that called Increasing Verbal Productions in Children with Autism. Don't write anything down. I'll give you the link at the end. Okay. Level three, and we're going to have to move ahead because I know we're running out a little bit of time here, but
you're fine.
Stage three, okay, you have a child saying individual words, able to tell you what they want. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. I'm thrilled. Congratulations. This is a big milestone. And again, in a child who would be typically developing, we see that around their first birthday, but maybe your child's three or four, maybe two. That's okay. That's wonderful. And what it means is that they are starting to understand a lot of language, and they're able to take that understanding and move it into the single word stage. And again, as I mentioned before, if you have a child that's stuck there and we can't move them beyond the single word stage, and you've tried and you've worked with speech pathologists, you've worked with your school system people, you know, it's time to evaluate what it is that we need to do. Well, a big mistake that a lot of speech pathologists make, and we're going to go on to slide 27, to tip three, is they don't spend enough time working on the development of what we call receptive language or language comprehension. They spend behaviorists, and I don't like to say that because my son is working on his master's to become a behaviorist, my older son, but he knows the pitfalls because we talk about it all the time. A lot of times with behaviorists, we find that they don't work on it. They have these terrific goals where they're trying to get the children to speak, but they're not spending enough time on working on understanding of language. And at this point of the game, when you have a child that's at the one-word stage and we're trying to move them into making sentences, small, short phrases, you have to do your due diligence, and you have to work on the what we call the receptive language. I'm a big proponent in working with computer-based software, so there are some, I'm going to tell you in a minute, I have done 6 webinars on computer-based software, and we talk about these stages, and we talk about different programs that you can use to work on language development that are available through with many different vendors, not just Laureate Learning. So if you ever want to do, I think there's 6 hours of webinar series that I've done, and I think it's, again, like $10 for all 6 hours. It's very inexpensive, but it gives you a lot of information. But, of course, there's many other ways of teaching understanding of language, how to get your child to understand things. But make sure that you don't want them to just be the imitators again. You want them to really understand and use language appropriately. Stage 4 are children, and our slide 28, who at this point are starting to develop simple sentences. They have maybe just core short sentences that they're saying. And, of course, our goal is, it's not hard to figure out, we want to move them to develop more complex sentences, more vocabulary development. And if we go to slide 29, I wanted to say that, and I bring this up because we have a lot of children who parents and speech pathologists and behaviorists have worked with to get them to say, I want. Well, I want you to ask yourself for a minute. If you have a child that says cookie, comes up to you and says cookie, what do they mean? What are they telling you? Are they telling you that they eat a cookie? Or are they telling you that there's a cookie somewhere in the universe? No, they're telling you that they want a cookie. So when we work diligently, and of course we all do it because it's an important thing, we teach the child to then expand that to say, instead of just cookie, we teach them to say, I want cookie. Essentially, we've taught them to communicate the exact same thing. I want cookie, and cookie basically communicates the exact same thing. It's a structure we need to teach that child, but we don't consider children who only are able to say, want this or want that, or I want cookie, I want juice, I want drink, I want chips, whatever, as being in stage 4. They would still be in stage 3. So if you have a child and the entire repertoire of their sentences uses I want you to consider them to still be single word users, just for the sake of finding and figuring out what the right goals would be to work on. However, if you have a child that uses more complex sentences, such as in the box, or boy eat a hot dog, or things like that, then they are a true stage 4. Okay, I have developed, if you have a child and you're trying to work on developing expressive grammar structures, I will tell you I have developed some really wonderful lessons that are used through PowerPoint. So if you have an opportunity, you might want to go on to my website and take a look at them, because they are really terrific. And they use visual means of teaching children sentences, which, as you know, if you have a child with autism, our children are very visual and they're visual learners. And I use that approach. I use a visual learning approach when I'm teaching language structure. Okay, let's go on to stage 5. Stage 5 are children that basically communicate in short, simple sentences. Not just phrases, but complete sentences, but short ones, not complex ones. They might say things like, I'm going to the store, or the boy is eating, or things like that. Short. And but you know, there's so much more to grammar. There's so much more to sentence structure. And it's going to the next stage. What we're really going to do is really expand on that sentence structure. Now, next slide, slide 32-5, is here's a little very common scenario that I have experienced with parents. They come to me and they say, you know, my child's talking in simple sentences. And every day they go to school, and when they come home, I say to them, what did you do at school? And they don't tell me. I don't understand that they're talking in simple sentences. Why can't they tell me what they did at school? And I tell them because though they're speaking in simple sentences, and simple sentences does not include what we call abstract concepts or past tenses. Abstract meaning, if you say to somebody, what did you do at school? That's not happening right now. That happened in the past. They're not thinking about the past. They're thinking about right now. It's not common for a child who's still in that stage, stage 5, to be thinking about things abstractly. We're not ready for that yet. Nor do they think in the past. They think in the present. But the good news is if we go to slide 33, is when... if and when we get them to stage 6, where they have pretty much mastered a lot of the grammatical rules and they're talking in pretty good sentences, and I'll tell you, I mean, the beauty of having been a speech pathologist for as many years as I have, 35, is I've had the opportunity to start with children at the age of 2 and work with them until adulthood. And there are a lot of individuals with autism that get to the stage 6s and 7s. It's not an unusual situation. They don't all do, but I have many that do, many. So don't feel if you have a small child that this is never going to happen. It's not true. It does happen. And when we get them to that level where they're basically talkers and, you know, they can talk about the past, they can talk about the future, they're talking in conversation. What do we work on at this point? Where do we go from them? Well, you can see what we're really going to really focus on at this point is an area called critical thinking. And critical thinking is basically the ability for an individual to use high-level reasoning skills. And if that doesn't come easy to individuals with autism, even older students, it's not easy. And it affects them in many arenas. It doesn't just affect them in their verbal communication, but it affects them in many areas. It affects them in their ability to read and reading comprehension. A lot of families will come to me and say, you know, my child, oh, you know, we have to pass these, I don't know about in other states, but in Florida we have these standardized tests that are required for our kids to pass called the FCATs. And, you know, they're just chocked full of all sorts of reading material that has all kinds of critical thinking, problematic reasoning, and all sorts of things on there. Very, very tough for some of our kids. But we work on that. That's a skill that we work on at this point. And we want to get them, if we go to the next slide, we want to get them to the point where we're working on the non-literal language, as I mentioned earlier, is a problematic area. Idioms and inferencing and phrases and underlying meanings and double entendres and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I don't know if any of you watch the show Parenthood, but I watched that show. I love it. It's on Tuesday nights. It wasn't on yesterday because of the debate, but it's on usually at 10 o'clock, and I think it's in the third season, and they are well known because they have, in the autism world, because one of the characters has Asperger, and he's a young boy. I think he's about 10 now. His name is Max. And they do a great job with illustrating some of these higher, his kid is a very good speaker, but they do a very good job of illustrating some of these higher level issues that individuals who are good speakers have. And the other day they were talking about something and one of the characters used an idiom. And, you know, he said, I don't get that. What does that mean? He's a very literal thinker. So that's something, again, very commonly when we're working with very good speakers who have gotten to this high level, we're going to work on these idioms. We're going to teach them what these things mean. We're going to get them to use it. A lot of times they'll rebel. They'll hate it. They'll say, this is stupid. Why would you say it's raining cats and dogs? How stupid. That doesn't make any sense. Just say it's raining and it's very heavy rains outside. They don't like idioms, so sometimes they'll fight you on it. But we have to explain to them that from a pragmatic sense, from a social sense, you have to learn how to use these idioms. And our last stage, which I'm going to take a moment to talk about while I get up for a minute and I walk over to this little house that I have with my son and get him because he needs to come over to my house. So if you hear a little noise in the background, it's just me getting my son and bringing him to my house because it's 10 o'clock here and his caregiver leaves and I need to bring him over here. But the last stage is complete generative grammar. That is really a child who, and I'm not saying perfect, if a total gets all the idioms, you're still going to be working on some of that non-literal language there for quite a while. You're still going to be working, I think really a lot of that non-literal language is a lifelong experience for them of learning different things. I think they go through a really long time. I mean, probably through the even the adult years where they finally realize, you know, that they have to talk with a non-literal language. So it doesn't mean they're going to get to the point where they totally get idioms and they totally get phrases and all these jokes and humor and all that. But they're pretty good and they're what is our goal at this point? Our goal at this point is that we really have to get them to the point where they are, we're going to really get into their academic skills in terms of what I guess you would call language reading and the literacy, you know, the literacy area. And we're going to be working with them in reading and writing skills too. People who have language issues oftentimes really need to get help in the areas of writing and reading as well. I mean, you're not going to find that that's going to be a perfect scenario for them. So, you know, that's, again, one of the areas that from a language perspective you're going to find that we're going to need to work on. Well, that's basically the meat and potatoes. If you see, you can go on to the slide 36. It basically says at that stage, language and literacy are married. We work on those things. But this is basically the end of my formal presentation for tonight. If you go to slide 37, I'll give you some of the resources that we talked about earlier. If you are interested in developing maybe some computer-based learning, language learning or reading or math or anything for your child, you may want to take the 6 webinar series. It's 6 hours of tons of information about using computer software that's been specifically developed for either language. It's not the kind of thing you go into a store and buy. This is specialty software. And again, I think it's like $10 for the series. If you go to slide 38, if you're interested in that but you don't want to spend 6 hours watching webinars, you can read my book that I wrote on the subject of technology. It's available on Amazon. And then I'm indulging myself a little bit. If you go to slide 39, I just wrote a book. If any of you out there, this is a fiction book, and it's for families who are ready to deal with the issue of what's going to happen to their child when they're no longer around. And if you want, if you can go there, if you feel like going there, you may really enjoy reading this book. You can get a hold of me. I mentioned to Nancy before the webinar started, I happen to be one of those people that's on a lot of those, you know, ask the experts, you know, and I'm constantly getting emails. It's not, they're not paid services. I do this as a volunteer. So I am totally open to anybody emailing me. You can see there is my email address, info@valeriehurstwitz.com. And if you're interested in any of the materials that we talked about today, you can go onto my website, simply valeriehurstwitz.com, or you can see them. I'm on Pinterest, my new favorite website, Pinterest. I'm on Twitter, and I do have a blog for parents who, because my son is 21 now, a lot of the personal things that I deal with having an adult child who I caregive for. And if that's something that you're interested in, you might want to join us on our blog, which is SNACKERS, because it's an abbreviation for Special Needs Adult Child Caregivers. It's a little bit of a play on words because not only do I love to do speech therapy, but I'm an avid baker and I love to eat, so that's a little play on the word SNACKERS. But and then we're on Facebook, or on Google. I do consultations, as I mentioned before. That is what I do for a living at this point. I no longer have a, I sold my therapy center in 2008, and I do private consultations with families. Like I said, anywhere. I help you to set up home programs. I help you to develop goals that you want to work on with your child in the area of language and speech, and we'd love to work with any of you. Feel free to email me if you want to get more information about that. And I'd like to say thank you for listening, and I hope to hear from you soon. And that's it for tonight, Nancy.
Great. Now, again, if you're on the phone and you have a question, you can press star 2. While I'm going to the question and the answers here, or the questions that have been coming in through the website, I have a question. If I've decided that my son is in stage 4 and I want to move him along to stage 5, do I start in stage 4?
No. Stage 4? No, if your son is at the stage where he's starting to put individual, you know, words together and make short phrases and sentences, what we would do at that point is we would evaluate what exact phrases he is putting together. You know, what is he actually saying? And we would analyze that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, if you want to give me an example of something he's saying?
He'll express an entire thought with one word at a time, like swimming, donuts, fun, duck.
Okay, so
he's not forming
the whole story.
But yeah.
Mm-hmm. He would be probably between a 3 and a 4.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would do is, from a resource perspective, lessons, what we call the sentence developer lessons, would probably be a good place to start, because we have to develop, when we're working on language, what we basically do when we're developing sentence structure, we're doing it basically by how a typical child would develop sentence structure. So in your son's case, for instance, he needs to learn the correct way of structuring sentences, even starting with how do you do two words at a time. Because he's not really formulating a phrase. He's kind of using one word at a time to tell you like a whole story.
Right.
And it's not like real sentence structure. So we would probably start by teaching him the correct way of formulating. We have about 14 different two-word methods. You know, there's actually 14 different two-word combinations we would teach him those, and we would teach him to express himself that way. And then once he does that, we would go into a little longer sentences and adding more structures in. But we would do it in a very sequential way. like I said, you know, there's, I don't know if he's getting speech therapy, but that would probably be the first place to start. Like, for instance, just to give you an example, we would probably start with something very simple like a subject and a verb. Getting him to use, instead of saying one word at a time, we would teach him how to say the subject and the verb, and then maybe the subject, verb, and object. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be the correct thing. And that would be,
and would it be appropriate to use picture prompts?
We do use picture prompts. If you look at the lessons, the sentence developer lessons that I created, let me see if we can go back to that slide for a minute because there's some illustrations there. If you go back to slide 30 and you see, like in the first picture where you see the ballerina, you can see that they are using picture prompts there. They're using the prompt of lady dance. And in the next picture, which would be a little bit more sophisticated lesson, they're using three pictures, baby, drink, milk. And if you go to the third one, you can see the picture prompts are boy, is, row, in, football. And again, it goes on and on and on, and we do use picture prompts. We eventually, what we're doing in the sentence developer lessons is after we teach the child to make sentences with the picture prompts, then we fade the prompts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a three-step process in each one of the lessons because, you use the prompts to develop the speech and the language structure, but then you have to get them to do it on their own, so we have to fade the prompts.
I got it.
Great. Great.
Regina from Pasadena asks, at what point do you consider a child no longer pre-verbal but non-verbal?
That's a really great question, and it comes up a lot. And again, we want to make sure that if you have worked with a child for quite a long time, let's say you have worked, you've tried to develop language, your child's maybe gotten to the point where they understand what they want to communicate. They understand it, but they cannot do it. And you're seeing signs of frustration. It very commonly happens. You know, you might have even had speech therapy for your child, and it just didn't take. And you can see that they are literally, let's say, a stage two person. Maybe they're pulling you to something that they want. And they're standing there, and you either have to figure it out using 20 questions, or you get to the point where, you know, they're very frustrated. Frustration has a lot to do with it. I wouldn't necessarily give up on trying to develop verbal abilities. I wouldn't say, oh, that's gone, it'll never happen, give up the dream. No, I wouldn't say that. But what I would say is it would be an indication that at this point in time you have a nonverbal child and you should start incorporating probably something like text or some other kind of picture communication or some kind of nonverbal augmentative communication. And again, you may still be working on speech. They don't have to be, you know, you don't go down the nonverbal road all the time and give up on working on developing verbal communication. No, they oftentimes, they're married together. But at that point in time, you recognize that your child is not pre-verbal, that they are at that moment nonverbal, and you have to incorporate some augmented communication skills. I hope that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. Tammy from Eastvale asks, my son is autistic, nonverbal, diagnosed with apraxia. He uses PECs, although he's not strong, and his teacher occasionally uses sign language in class. Is that confusing, using PECs and sign along with verbal?
Well, I'm not a big, it depends, I don't know exactly what she means when she says my son's child is using sign language. One thing I don't like personally is when a teacher signs to a child who's not a signer. Then they're watching teacher move her hands and they don't have any idea what it is. If they are trying to teach in signs, and again, I'm very, very, very picky about how signs are taught, you know, so I can't really comment on how this teacher is teaching signs. I don't know if it's being successful with her son or not. But again, if he's not that strong in PECs, and again, I would have to sort of troubleshoot it and see, is he not strong in PECs because it doesn't seem to be his thing, or is it not being taught appropriately? Yeah, that's, I get called in all the time. This is a very common scenario where people have tried different methods with their children, and they don't know if they should give up that method and move on to a different method, or maybe that method isn't being taught correctly. And it's not uncommon for a school to have pictures that they call PECs, but they haven't really done due diligence on teaching that child how to use PECs going through the six stages. They may have the pictures up in the classroom, but they may not go through the laborious one-to-one six-stage protocol that PECs requires. And so that's sometimes why the child's not very strong on PECs. And again, with the sign language, if it's not being taught systematically on a one-to-one basis with her son, it just might be going over his head. You know, he might just be seeing this person using signs, but if there's not a person that's sitting with him teaching him one-to-one and he's not picking it up, it could be the method that they're using to teach it rather than, you know, I mean, the technique that they're using rather than the method. So that's really hard to say. So my recommendation to Tammy is that she, is it Tammy or Regina? I don't remember.
I can't either. I went on.
Okay. Is to ask to watch, observe, or to ask questions on the techniques they are using to teach her son. And if they are teaching, say to them, are you using the six-step protocol to teach my son PECs? Are you using photos, or are you using the more traditional symbolic pictures, which I don't think often work? And when you're teaching sign language, are you sitting one-to-one and teaching in sign language? And what strategies are you using to teach in sign language? And from that information, she can email me at info@valeriehurstwitz.com, and we can go from there. But, you know, I hate to say that it's not the right method, because it might be. It might just not be being taught effectively.
And do you think it's okay to use a combination, or should they stick to just one method?
It, again, depends on the child. My son is always done well with lots of different. He uses PECs, he uses iPad, and he uses sign is his primary method. So it really depends on a child. My guess is that for a new augmentative communication person, I would stick with one system for a while until that child is pretty good with that system. It's not any different than teaching, you know, a child language. If you're teaching a child two languages at the same time, you may run the risk, if it's a child with a language delay. If you have a child with a language delay and you're trying to teach them English and, let's say, French at the same time, that's going to be rather confusing. So, but once they would learn English or once they would learn French, then you could introduce the second language. So it's probably similar with a child who has a language delay from autism and when using two different kinds of systems. I would stick with one for the time being until they either realize that that system isn't going to be the right one and they move on, or that child masters that system, and then you have to ask yourself whether you need another system or not, or whether it's time to introduce it. With my son, he started to reject the visual communication, and I knew at that point we had to find something else. I mean, he was good at it. He was incredible at using tests, but he started to reject it, and that's why I started to introduce first, I introduced the voice output system, and then as he started to reject that, I remember we were on a vacation, and I didn't bring the voice output system with me, and I introduced sign language while we were on this vacation, and he immediately wanted to do it. He just wasn't very good at it, which is why we had to change the systems up. So sometimes you have to, some children are going to gravitate towards one thing or another, and it's maybe, you know, different points in their lives when you introduce it. It wasn't until he was 10 that we really introduced sign language. So sometimes, it's not a steady course all the time, that once the child learns something, that's going to be their system for the rest of their lives.
I see. I have noticed with my son, he's 15, he's verbal to a point, but when he gets mad, he loses his ability to verbalize, and he regresses back to his signs. So he may sign help when he's so frustrated he can't say help.
See, I like that. I mean, I find that to be good because he has it's funny because a lot of times with kids that I work with, it's the opposite. When they get really mad, it's when their speech is the best. And I always say, you know, it's like, they're so mad that the adrenaline is just flowing in their system, that the adrenaline must stimulate some brain functioning or something. Because I often have kids that are just so mad that that's when they get the best speech out of them. But in your son's case, the stress might be creating like, sort of like for us, when we're under a lot of stress, you know, maybe our thought processes aren't really at the tip-top shape at that point. So sometimes maybe it shuts down, and that might be what happens with him. But I find that most people that don't have great verbal communication, in the long run, like my son, who's not even as sophisticated as your son, language-wise, probably do better with multi-systems for different situations. You know, again, sign language for him, for your son, is like almost like his first language, so he may go to it. And verbal communication might be the harder of the two things. So he might go to it when he just needs to communicate, but the words are just not coming in his brain. And I think that he's lucky to be able to do that and have somebody who understands that.
Right. Rosa from Troy asks, is it helpful to get outside speech and language help? She said she has a high-functioning 7-year-old boy who takes speech therapy at school, and she just wanted to know if she should seek additional help.
I would say yes, because normally, and of course, I don't know the setup she has in the school she's in. If she has public school, normally public school is the way that the funding is done, it's not usually one-to-one, and it often isn't pull-out. So pull-out is when a speech therapist comes into the classroom and says, Johnny, it's time for speech, come with me, and she takes him into a room and works with him or with a group. But these days, a lot of the speech pathologists in the school systems, and this is very good, it's a very good thing, they go into the actual classroom and they work with the children in a more naturalistic environment. And I think that's good. But then there's a gap because a lot of speech therapy involves intensive one-to-one teaching and training of certain skills. And if that's not what your child is getting in his public school system, like for instance, I don't really know what kind of issues he has, but if he needs to work on sentence structures, let's say, it's not incidental learning, which is what happens in a classroom when somebody's learning something that they're exposed to, but it's not something that's actually taught to them. That might not be enough to teach him things that he needs. So I would say, in general, having run a therapy center where we offered group and individual therapy after school, and that was the cornerstone of what I did for 30 years, we were definitely big proponents of working with children in a one-to-one or a small group setting after school. So in general, I would say yes. I think that would be probably in her best interest.
And along those lines, do you think it's a good idea or important for the parents to either sit in or observe so they can continue what you're doing at home?
Well, that's what I always did. It depends. Right now, I make my living by consulting with families and teaching them how to work with their children at home. Now, think about it for a minute. If you take your child to a speech pathologist, normally, if on average, a person is going to be getting therapy for maybe 2 hours a week, something like that. But really, if the research indicates that to really change behavior, it needs to be more intensive. So if you think about it, it's almost a necessity for a parent to be able to work with their child on a more frequent basis, even if it's not sitting at a table like the speech pathologist does. Maybe it's just reinforcing some of the things that the speech pathologist taught them in the session. But I have been a huge proponent of parents working with their kids, whether it's in a structured environment where they're sitting at a table working or whether it's in a more naturalistic setting. But I'm a very big proponent out of it. But that said, not all parents can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you should feel guilty if you don't have that kind of relationship with your child. I mean, there are some children who don't work well with their parents. They rebel. They hate it. They oftentimes, people who have autism put other people in a little box of what their use is, you know, and it's not uncommon for me to see a parent who is thought of by their child as, you know, the mom is the person who is supposed to make me food and take me to school, give me a bath and dress me. They're not the person that's supposed to sit at the table and work on speech stuff with me, and they may, you know, have a problem with that. Or the parent may maybe get very frustrated working with their own child. Maybe it's just not their thing. So though I'm a big proponent, I'm only a big proponent if it's a successful situation. And many speech pathology centers, as mine did, have what we call observation windows, which you don't even have to come into the session to work with the speech pathologist. You can look inside the window. It's usually a two-way mirror, a one-way mirror so that the parent can look in and the person on the other side can't see going the other direction. So that's something to consider. But, you know, if you think that you have a good relationship with your child and they're going to be receptive, you can give it a try. And, you know, so it really depends. I'm a proponent of it, but it doesn't always work.
You touched on this briefly, but Zimmy from Ethiopia asks, what are the consequences of using two languages while teaching speech? For example, English and Amharic. We teach in English, and at home they use Amharic, Ethiopian language. And as well, we use English phonetics, and verbally we use Amharic.
Okay, great question, and welcome from Ethiopia. This comes up all the time. I live in Florida, so we have a lot of bilingualism here. Theoretically, a child who has any kind of a language delay, I mean, we're not just talking about a language delay due to autism, but just, you know, language, even a mild language delay due to other reasons, oftentimes have language confusion with two languages. Typical children, on the other hand, don't. So you can... If a child is developing language normally, we often do introduce two languages at once. But a child who has a language delay doesn't normally do well with two languages. So what do? You don't just say, forget it, they're only going to learn one language. Sometimes that's very impractical. Same situation. What happens if you have one language of the school, which, like, let's say in the States might be English, so you go home to parents who are not very good English speakers. Or grandma comes over and grandma speaks absolutely no English. So you have to be realistic. So what we recommend obviously our first choice would be only stick to one language. But if that is socially impossible and it's going to really ruin relationships that that child would have, then the second best thing is to be very consistent. That would be that you would always have the exact same scenario going on, which sounds like what they're doing over there in Ethiopia. If you would, because that way the child segments their life. They say, okay, when I'm in school, I'm going to hear this language. And when I'm home, I'm going to hear this language. Or when this person talks to me, I'm going to hear this language. When this person talks to me, I'm going to hear another language. Therefore, it should be very consistent. So you don't want to have a parent who sometimes is speaking one language and sometimes is speaking another. You know, if you need to introduce two languages into that world of that child, then be very consistent. The same person should always use one language and the other person should use the other language. And it sounds to me that that's what's going on there. But you have to look at your own child. If your child is, if you feel that that child is very confused and, you know, you're not progressing, you know, you may have to take more drastic measures and try and cut out one of the languages. But, you know, I don't know why you also ask yourself, why is English important for a child in Ethiopia? Is it a bilingual state, you know, country? I don't know. So there's a lot of factors that come into consideration. It's not the best if you have to introduce two languages, but if you're going to and it's necessity, then try and be very consistent.
Makes sense. Jackie from Las Vegas asks, I have a 17-year-old son who can speak, but he will not initiate conversation or ask questions verbally. He will only speak through email or Facebook. I have tried social scripts and bribes, but they don't work. How do I get him to communicate, or do I give up and get him an iPad for communication?
So he's verbal with Facebook?
It seems as if he can speak, but he would prefer to type.
And how old is he again?
17.
Well, that's a tough one. It's unusual. By the way, just to let the listeners know, we do on occasion have individuals that we work with that have good language skills through writing or typing. But that is very unusual because the deficits or language are usually in the brain, not in the actual tongue or lips or motor or movements. It's usually in the brain. So usually if they can't talk, they usually don't have the greatest, you know, fabulous language writing. I mean, they may have some, but not so great. If she's knocked herself out and he is just not happy being the verbal communicator and his life is good the way it is, I mean, he's happy with his life, I would say leave it alone. On the other hand, if he looks like he's unhappy and not having verbal skills is really impairing him, and again, at 17, I'm not going to ask mom if she's happy. I'm going to ask him if he's happy because very frequently you get into these issues with teenagers where the parent wants something, but the child's perfectly happy and they're functional for whatever it is their purposes are in the universe. So, you know, it all depends on if he's happy and then how far in life you expect he's going to go. I mean, is he a person that she thinks he's going to be independent eventually? Is he that high functioning? Well, he might then need to learn more verbal or use more verbal language. But, you know, verbal language for him might be very taxing. It might be very tiring. He might, and again, this is a very unusual thing, but he might have just a really great command of the language using writing and typing. And for him, that might be his choice. So, you know, I can't give you a definitive answer unless I saw him or I was able to get more information on him. But if she's done 101 different things to try and stimulate him verbally, and there's just nothing she can do, she's, you know, used behavioral methods and bribery, and he's still not doing it, yet he has this great ability to communicate via writing, she might have to leave it alone.
Mm-hmm. And there are voice output devices where he could type what he wanted to say and it would speak it, right?
Well, that's the beauty of an iPad, because the iPad goes beyond any of these voice output systems now. And for a fraction of the price and for a fraction of the learning curve. And the beauty of having an iPad for a 17-year-old is that it's more socially acceptable. And, you know, there's a variety of things you can do with it. There's some terrific apps. I don't know, again, not knowing exactly how high of a communicator he is, but there's some unbelievable apps and, you know, that speak what we call text-to-speech. And, you know, I would go that route. There's, you know, we have other devices that have been used in the past, but, you know, these days it's just, you might as well go with the latest technology, which would be an iPad.
When I worked at Goodwill Easter Seals in the assistive technology department, I know those communication devices were, you know, $5,000-$6,000.
Mm-hmm.
And an iPad, maybe $300-$400.
Well, my son's device before he got his iPad was $7,000. He had a Dynavox 5.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the iPad came out, I mean, it was like, I had fought the school system for this Dynavox 5 for like years, and then I got it, and then I didn't want it.
Right.
So, you know, like, I said, thank you, but no thank you. It's like, but they knew. And then, now the school systems, there's practically, well, I can't say this, but I guess there shouldn't be any reason that a school system wouldn't be able to get an individual who needs an iPad for whatever reason to communicate or to learn from, because they are, the difference in pricing is ridiculous. So it should make it quite more affordable for more school systems to purchase these types of things for our students.
And the versatility is just remarkable. I mean, you have a communication device that does basically one thing, and you have to
right.
take all these hours to program each button to say what you want it to say. When you get an iPad, you've got all those apps.
Exactly. And, well, when I had the Dynavox, the reason I wanted the Dynavox 5 at the time for my son was because it was that same kind of idea. It was the first device out there that had what we call integrated technology. So it was a computer as well as a voice output system. And that's what I wanted for him. I wanted him to be able to have both. He uses the iPad for, my son personally uses the iPad for many things, but he uses it for, he's a good baker. And what we'll do is we'll put all the steps, like, you know, for the recipe on the iPad, and he uses that to follow along things that he needs to do. And, you know, it's just one of the things that you can do for, even in a more simple fashion, for a lot of the kids that I work with, just training them in self-help skills. You know, we take photographs, and in 2 seconds with an iPad 2, they're on the iPad, and, you know, we can immediately, I mean, we can go literally from getting the pictures to teaching in 30 seconds and get them up there and working with them. It's just phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Did you say that Blake is mostly nonverbal?
He's totally nonverbal.
Totally nonverbal, okay.
Mm-hmm. He's totally nonverbal. Unfortunately, as people get older, not all of them, but a lot of them, depending on their abilities. People like my son get more he's gotten more strict in his routine. He likes things to be the same, which and that's just who he is. He likes life to be the same. He likes his daily life to be pretty much Tuesdays is bowling, Thursdays is basketball, and Saturdays is swimming, you know, after school activities. And he likes that sameness. We have a visual board up in his room, and we always put a schedule up there every day, and he follows it. He puts the people up that need to be in his life. So it doesn't that kind of sameness doesn't promote a lot of new communication. What does promote new communication for him is introducing within the same realm, like a new recipe. Then we can have new pictures, you know, things like that. So he recently learned to make quiche, and quiche is great because it's really easy. It's like 5 ingredients, but you can vary it up a little bit. So we can introduce new pictures every now and then into his device, and that'll throw him a little curveball. But when the kids are younger, you know, your goal is to expose them to a lot of opportunities, a lot of different things, and that really is what encourages the development of communication.
This may be completely in left field, but do you believe that the brain then becomes hardwired at some point?
Well,
that
gets into the concept of neuroplasticity. And no, I have to tell you that a lot of the individual I work with a lot, like I said, having had the ability of being with the same kids from the time they're 2 and now they're adults. No, they're constantly learning new things. It may not only be in the area of communication, but I'm working, as you and I talked about before this talk, we're working on developing some programming for adults after they age out of the school system. And the program that we're developing is a micro business. It's called micro business and self-employment. And we're actually starting to work with these individuals to teach them things like baking, jewelry making, farming, all sorts of things. And they're learning new skills. So, and they never did these things before. I have individuals that come to me that are 25 and I'm teaching them how to do laundry. They never learned that. Nobody ever taught them how to do laundry. Or to wash the dishes or set the table or, you know, we're doing lots of new things, lots of new things.
Well, that's going to come as a relief to a lot of parents to know that, you know, there's no certain window.
Mm-mm.
We're all learning all the time.
Mm-hmm. I think there's different. I think there does come a point where a parent will say to themselves, you know, I have to give up the dream that my child's going to become this unbelievable speaker. I mean, some of our kids do get there. Like I said, I've worked with lots of them that do. But there's some that max out. Their potential maxes out from a communication perspective, maybe verbally. But we can begin to introduce other things into their lives that give them growth, you know. And it may not only be in the area of communication, like I said, it may be in other areas. But there is a point where I think from a verbal perspective, we do have to sometimes say, you know, I had to do that with my son. And being a speech pathologist, you can imagine how hard that was. That I had to eventually say to myself, you know, my son isn't going to be a verbal communicator in any way, shape, or form. But that didn't mean that he couldn't still grow and develop in other forms of communication and in other areas, and he does. This baking thing came totally out of left field. Just, you know, I recently had become a pastry chef as an addition to being a speech pathologist, and I was just in the kitchen a lot. And that's the story for another day. And he came in and just got into it and loved it and just had a real, and this was like at the age of like 18, maybe 19, and really took to doing it. So you just never know what kind of things are going to happen and what kind of interest that your individual that you love as a child is going to have an interest in. And that's why my you know, for more, of course, we're going outside the realm of language now, but I'm involved in, you know, in training in non-language areas as well. And this is how I feel. Every person can learn to do something purposeful. That is absolutely how I feel. In my therapy center, we had a separate building, and we ran a program called Pathways to Independent Living, and that was for adolescents and young adults. And our goal was there to teach. This was occupational therapists, not the speech therapists as much, but the occupational therapists worked over there with them. And our goal over there was to make every human being purposeful in some manner, shape, or form. And, you know, they were older, and they learned new things.
Good.
And very good at it, some of them.
Yeah, I don't think we should ever quit trying.
Mm-hmm. they can surprise you in many ways.
Yes. Sarah from Noble asks, my son is 7, and my computer just reset. So I'm going back into Q&A. It was like went to sleep because we were chit-chatting so long. But Sarah was talking about her son being 7, and my computer is going absolutely crazy here. Let me find Sarah again. Okay, my son is 7 and says a few words, but mostly is gibberish to everyone else. You really have to pay attention and watch his signs to understand what he's saying. She says she works with him every night on sight words from school and notices that he pronounces many letters the same. He can say the letter, but not the sound it makes. And she wants to know what might be an easier way to teach the sound other than look at my mouth or watch mommy. She said she can feel that he wants to talk, but he can't make his mouth cooperate.
Well, Sarah, your son has apraxia or dyspraxia, and that's a very common situation in our kids. And what that means is back to something that we talked about earlier, which is motor planning. The brain is just not telling the mouth the right way to move to make these sounds. It's very, very difficult for him. There are some terrific techniques out there for teaching children. My recommendation is you have to work on motor planning. I would recommend the program that we talked about earlier, one of the ones that we talked about, which was called VisiWords, which is a program that's done in a lesson format, kind of like a PowerPoint presentation, a VisiWords approach. And that's where we teach a child motor planning and imitation skills first. So what we would do with your son is we'd back it up a little bit and we'd work at teaching him how to imitate certain oral motor movements first. And once he got really good at that, we would then gradually bring in the development of teaching him motor planning. There is a wonderful motor planning program that I use when I work with kids. It's called Kaufman Practice Treatment Program. And it's a cornerstone program. You can buy it. You can use it at home. It is usually used with a speech pathologist, but you can use it at home. And I highly recommend it. It is a motor planning approach to teaching sound, Kaufman Practice Treatment Program. That, in combination with my program, which is VisiWords, in combination with an oral motor planning approach to teaching motor movements, will probably help him develop speech better than what she's doing now.
So busy writing notes for myself. I can't even scan these questions.
And I want to tell you, like I said, she can email me more, and I'll be happy to answer, you know.
And like I told Valerie before we started, I'll be sending her all these questions that are coming in through the website. So if we don't get to your question, she'll be receiving the questions too. So you can either email her, or she may just go ahead and respond to you personally.
And I'm good at that. I really am good. Give me a couple of days, and I'll definitely respond to you guys.
See, the problem that I have with school-based speech therapy is I don't know what he's working on because I'm not there. So is it confusing to him if they're working on something different at school than we're working on at home, or should we all be on the same page?
It depends on if they're working on a totally different goal. You know, sometimes school-based goals are different than your individual therapy goals because you implement different things in a different environment. I'll give you an example. If it's more pragmatic social skill development that they're working on at school and your individual speech therapist is working on language structure, it's probably not going to be a problem. But if they're working on language structure and your speech pathologist in after school is working on language structure, I would definitely say they have to coordinate. Now, as a private practitioner, and I required this of my therapist that worked in my office, we oftentimes liaisoned with the speech pathologist in the school system and had little phone conferences with them, and or at least looked at the IEP, you know, to see what they were doing. So, you know, I really believe in the integrated approach that, you know, all professionals should try and stay in contact with each other. The other thing is you can establish, I sometimes do case management, and what I'll do is I'll create a book where I'll have each individual, every time they see that child, put just a small couple of sentences in. And that book goes with that child everywhere they go, so that everybody that works with that child can go back and say, oh, so-and-so yesterday worked on this with that child. Okay, so-and-so, you know, worked on this with that child. And everybody, it's like a flow sheet or flow chart of what's worked on. You know, you can have areas. You can have speech therapy. You can have occupational therapy. You can have behavior. You can have all your little areas in your notebook, and everybody's just jotting down a little note. I do know that there's software on the market now. Off the top of my head, I can't think of what. I think Butterfly Effect might have something where you can have a subscription service, and I think some of the school systems are actually doing it, where notes are put into a child's chart online so that every professional puts their notes in online with that child. And therefore, everybody has access to that child's universe, and you know, everyone tries to work together. I think that technology, or the technology is certainly available. I think the use of it is probably just starting to come. You know, we have to train people to start utilizing that kind of thing. But we could look into that. I think Butterfly Effect does have that.
Several of my friends have young children that use echolalia, but have no spontaneous language themselves.
Mm-hmm.
How can they transition their child from, or is it a separate entity altogether that you just, the echolalia is just one of those things that's there and language is separate?
There's different kinds of echolalia. We have immediate echolalia, we have delayed echolalia.
Uh-huh.
Immediate echolalia is if I say to you, what do you want? You say to me, what do you want?
Uh-huh.
That kind of echolalia is usually indicative of the fact that we need to work on receptive language with that child. I think I mentioned that in one of the slides, one of the tips, is that if you have a child when you get to like stage three and you're at the single word stage and you don't spend your due diligence working on receptive language, and instead you put all your energy into trying to teach them to express, putting words together without teaching them what they mean, you're going to get a child with a lot of echolalia because they just don't understand spoken language. So that's why they repeat you. They don't. Very common is that they'll repeat the last word. You know, you'll say, "Let's go get some ice cream," and they'll say, "Ice cream." A lot of times, that's indicative that they just don't understand what you're saying. So you've got to work on receptive language. If you have a child with delayed echolalia, that's the type of child that recites the jingles from the TV commercials, or they can tell you a whole video or whatever, but they don't have a lot of spontaneous language. That kind of a child is probably stimming, and they have that kind of language. The delayed echolalia is probably stimming. You know, they enjoy themselves and they're entertaining themselves that way.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the child, some of that echolalia is a good indication that they have language and that they can be encouraged to develop language skills. Some children, it doesn't mean that. It might just mean that they like to stim all the time, and you know, they like to use that language. But again, a lot of it goes back to receptive language, and one of the reasons that they might not have, I mean, if they're doing a whole jingle, it means that they're acting kind of like the way a parrot acts, and that means that they have the opposite of dyspraxia. They have very good motor planning, but they probably have extreme, which means that they can say words, but they probably have very poor ability to understand what they're saying. They probably have no comprehension of what it is they're saying. They're just repeating, and they're auditory learners. So we would take an auditory approach rather than a visual approach with them and teaching them language. So I'm not sure, you know, I'm not knowing what methodologies
right.
have been used. It may be, you know, a wrong approach that's being used to that child.
The one in particular I'm thinking of is just fascinating to me, because if he sees an animal on TV, for instance, a horse, he has these flashcards that when he presses the button, it reads, you know, a horse is tall and it has a long mane and a long tail, and you can put a saddle on it and you can ride it, and it has all this stuff it says at the bottom. If he sees a horse, he will go get the flashcard and verbally tell you what it says at the bottom, though he can't read. He just remembers what it said.
That's excellent, actually.
I find that fascinating.
Well, like what he's doing is he's memorizing the configuration of the word.
Huh. Fascinating. And that can be molded into actual language, do you believe?
Oh, it can be molded into sight word reading, becoming
yeah.
a great sight word reader. There's a really good software program that Laureate offers called Sentence Master, and it kind of uses that technique. And it's a great I use that a lot for teaching reading.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't teach any phonics. It doesn't teach any. It just teaches that kind of, for a person that has that kind of ability. Kind of like when a child passes a McDonald's, it's not that they're reading the word McDonald's, but those word McDonald's may not even be the golden arches. It may be actual the word McDonald's. It's not that they read the word McDonald's, it's they recognize it and they are able to pair that up with what it is. It's not like they know that the M and the C and the D, you know, they don't recognize individual letters, but that configuration together, they know what it is.
Yep. My son is by far not a reader, but there are words in the community that he picks out, like thank you and exit.
Right, right. That's the same kind of thing.
Yeah,
and
he'll point those out.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I have to go put my son to sleep. It's 11 p.m.
I'm gonna make my final announcements,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to let you go take care of your son.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight, Valerie, and sharing all this wonderful information with us. I would love to have you back.
My pleasure.
Because I think we just scratched the surface here. People have a lot of questions, so I'm going to be sure and forward these to you so you can address them too. So thanks so much for being with us, and I hope you have a nice evening.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to hearing some of the questions that those of you who I wasn't able to answer tonight, but I will definitely email you back, I promise. Take care.
Thanks. Good night.
Good night.
And for those of you still with me, if you want a transcript of this event, please join our Spectrum Gold Club.